Synod, it's Valentine's Day, and no draft measure is complete without its draft accompanying canon. And so we're now moving on to item 507, which covers some similar territory to what we've just been talking about. This is Article 7 business. Its first consideration, you will need the draft amending canon itself, which is GS2047, and the explanatory memorandum, which is GS2047X. And I'm going to call on the Chair of the Steering Committee, the Venerable Jane Steen, again, to move item 507, that this canon may be considered for revision in committee. She may speak for not more than 10 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. Like the measure, the amending canon originates from proposals developed by the Simplification Task Group. And having already set out the general background policy in introducing the measure, I will deal with the canon more briefly. Paragraphs 1 to 3 are intended to help the situation of multi-parish benefices, especially those in rural areas where a number of parishes are spread across a wide area. The canons that provide for the services of morning and evening prayer and the celebration of Holy Communion in parish churches are currently drafted on the basis that these services will take place in every parish church on every Sunday and every principal holy day. The reality in many places was already very different. In fact, the reality was very different even in the 1960s when the current canons were originally devised. A parish priest cannot be in two or more places at once, though many have wished it were otherwise. In many benefices, in some cases where the number of parish churches is in double figures, it is simply not possible for there to be services in every parish church every Sunday and every principal holy day. No one realistically expects it, but the canons do. And if the statutory services are not to be held in a particular parish, the priest should obtain a dispensation from the bishop. Paragraphs 1 to 3 amend the relevant canons so that the statutory services have to be held in at least one church in every benefice on every Sunday and principal holy day. There is therefore no change in the canonical requirement for a single parish benefice. In a multi-parish benefice, the canon may not result in any practical change, but it will mean that the parish priest is no longer in breach of the canons if a dispensation is not obtained from the bishop not to hold the statutory services in every one of the parish churches in the benefice. Paragraph 4 replaces existing canons B43 and 44 with a single new canon that covers ecumenical activity. This reflects the amendments being made to the ecumenical relations measure to which I have already referred. It is hoped that this new single canon on ecumenical relations will be easier to follow than its predecessors. The policy has been to include only as much detail as is necessary and to leave other matters to the code of practice to be made by the House of Bishops. This should mean that practical changes may in future be made without needing to revise the canon. Paragraph 5, which extends the range of situations in which a deacon or priest may serve a title, relies on Clause 5 of the measure already discussed. Under the existing canon law, an ordinand must normally be ordained to a title as assistant curate in a particular benefice or parish. Under this new provision, it will be possible for ordinands to be ordained to serve in any office held under common tenure. And this would include being licensed to a bishop's mission initiative or a non-parochial institution. Paragraph 6 makes amendments to Canon C8 so that any member of the clergy who is beneficed or licensed in a diocese will, in effect, also have permission to officiate anywhere in that diocese at the invitation of the minister with the cure of souls. This is intended to allow beneficed and licensed clergy the same flexibility in terms of providing cover and general deployment as those who hold the bishop's permission to officiate. Paragraphs 7 and 8 make amendments to the canons that are to the same effect as Clause 6 of the measure. They remove the requirement for a person to have been in holy orders to be eligible for appointment as a dean, archdeacon, or residentiary canon. They therefore bring parity with the appointment of bishops, although the eagle-eyed among you will have noticed that the canons offer us an age limit for consecration as bishop, and that is not being imposed in relation to deans, archdeacons, or residentiary canons. And I leave you to do the maths, and no doubt write to the revision committee, as you have previously been invited so to do. Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. This item is now open for debate. I will remind members that Understanding Order 51 speeches must be directed to the general purport of the canon rather than to points of detail. Mr. Philip French and Robert. Tony.
Philip French, Rochester 388. So even with the proposed amendment, Canon B11 will still require that morning and evening prayer is celebrated in at least one church in every benefice or plurality every Sunday, unless special dispensation is agreed by the diocesan bishop. Is this transparent, realistic, or effective? I know of no church in my locality where morning and evening prayer are routinely celebrated every Sunday. Nor, I dare to suggest, has our good diocesan bishop been much involved in permitting this delinquency. Instead, there are many patterns of worship, well adjusted to the needs of the parishes and the availability of ministers, including weekday services and fresh expressions, which is well attuned to being the church in the present age. Why must we maintain the fiction of Canon B11, even as amended? Yes, Canon B14a allows for its requirements to be set aside. But what's the point of a canon that simply isn't normative, and where the defined exception procedure is unlikely to be followed with any great enthusiasm? Canon B11 sadly describes a 19th century Church of England, not a 21st century one. A general duty to provide a service scheme which is locally appropriate, which encourages mission, and which meets with the approval of the diocesan bishop might be a more fruitful way to proceed. And now for something completely different. As someone who worships in a local ecumenical partnership, I thoroughly welcome the intent of new Canon B43, a simpler, single ecumenical canon, which gives greater flexibility both now and for the future. And I understand the language of a cooperative scheme being to help with that. I'm just a little surprised at what it doesn't even mention. It's largely concerned with ministry and worship. So far, so good. But it doesn't even touch on questions of governance, finance, or the relationship of a local congregation to the wider councils of the church and its administrative structures. As I said earlier, these things matter, but our legal and regulatory framework is almost silent on them. I'm certainly not asking for rules which cover every eventuality. They would be bound to fail. And I note what the Archdeacon said about a future code of practice. But surely we could at least acknowledge the need for sensitive attention to matters such as managing financial contributions to more than one denomination, statistical and financial reporting likewise, and balancing the approaches of different church traditions to local church governance without overwhelming laity or clergy with ever more meetings. So I hope the Revision Committee might consider those two points. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Tony Baldry, followed by the lady at the back there, please.
Tony Baldry, Oxford 373. As I go around the country in my capacity as chair of the Church Buildings Council, I come across, as I'm sure we all do here, many churches which are rarely used. And we don't want to see these churches close. We want to keep them open as buildings for Christian witness, but I think we have to be realistic that the pattern of our church buildings owes as much to the Norman conquest and the whole system of manners that followed from that occupation as it does to any kind of rational reflection of the distribution of our population. So, what we in the Church Buildings Council, as you may know, have an attempt to keep churches open, have set up and are setting up the Association of Festival Churches. And the idea is that, one, churches which aren't used that often might have services about 6 or 7 times a year to raise sufficient money to pay the insurance, keep the guttering cleared, and also bring the community together from time to time. So hopefully we'll see a revival of Plough Sunday, Rogation, Candlemas, which is sort of Christingle for grown-ups, anything that you can think of. And if anyone's got any ideas for good festivals, please will you share them with us, because we want to keep our churches open, and in any event, no one wants a large number of redundant Grade 1 listed buildings. Thank you.
Carolyn Graham, Guildford 317. I want to make a general point about the language, and I'll ask the Revision Committee to consider it. In my day job, I'm a government lawyer, and as such, I sometimes draft legislation, and modern legislation has to be drafted using gender-neutral language, and it can get tricky, as it has here, in amending older legislation. As an example, in the explanatory memorandum on page 6, in clause C5(1), some of the deleted language refers to he, and it's been replaced quite correctly with the gender-neutral term, the bishop. However, we then move on to paragraph 2E, when you're going back to the gender-specific language, his. Now, there's two difficulties with this. First of all, it's just messy, jumping between different types of language. And secondly, it doesn't reflect the modern situation that ministers and bishops come in both male and female varieties. If we were going to draft this legislation from start, we wouldn't draft it like this nowadays. And so can I suggest the Revision Committee, when reviewing their legislation, don't only simplify it, but improve it. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Stelibras, and then lady over there, please.
Mike Stalybras, York 439. I want to draw members' attention to the nature of the explanatory memorandum that we have, and in particular the appendix. It is very clear what is being changed, because we can see at the same time both the existing canon and the revised canon. Stark contrast with the very able fleet of foot work which we got from the Bishop of Wilsdon this morning as he was taking us through some other revisions to draft legislation. Now, the point that I'm making may actually be better addressed to the business committee than it is to this individual thing, but I do believe that as members of Synod, it is helpful whenever we can see the before and after effect of drafting changes. And I would commend that we, whenever we have modifications to legislation, as a synod, we are able to see in some form or another how the before and after reads. And I know that being able to do this is actually possible, and I'm very happy to engage in further conversations to facilitate this.
Thank you. Julie DeSiegel. Yes. And then you, sir.
Julie DeSiegel, Oxford 377. I was interested to read in this proposed change to canon more simplification measures to make it easier if you're in a multi-parish benefice. I'm afraid that I'm not sure that the multi-parish benefice is the best way forward. I think perhaps we need to think about creating larger parishes. In Oxford, we have currently 622 parishes, many of which are tiny. Bishop's Council last week, we approved a scheme to combine 5 of those, so we go down to 618. Many of our parishes, like the churches that Tony Baldry just spoke about, the boundaries were drawn up a very long time ago. I've lived in my town in Buckinghamshire for about a quarter of a century, And I've seen, with the moving of the post office and the redevelopment of Sainsbury's, the centre of the town shift from one end to the other. Our populations have shifted as well. I do think that our mission would be easier if we had larger parishes and the parish boundaries were redrawn. And I think although simplification can make doing that easier, we do actually have to attend to this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Paul Hutchinson, York 243. Three things to say. Firstly, in relation to Canon C11, I want to echo what Philip French said earlier about reflecting modern realities and just make the additional observation that that's precisely what we're aiming to do in our discussion on Canon B8 about vesture. Why not do it with C11 at the same time and enable things to go forward? We don't all say morning prayer in our churches. I say that in the presence of my Lord Archbishop, though, of course, we do have morning worship of various kinds. Secondly, as an ecumenical officer, to welcome the canons, as everyone else has done. It is good that we are having change on that score. But thirdly, and to focus for a moment on the canons that are coming through almost on the nod, not quite, Andrew Dotchin referred to the desire for seniority in the last debate. There is a detail of difference between what's going through in these canons and what is going through on the measure. And the detail of difference is that in these canons, any residentiary canon appointment is being removed altogether from the requirement that the person be in orders. The drafting has taken them out of Canon C21. Now, given all the complexity around cathedrals and all the hot potato issues we've had recently, and all the questions as to where lay governance appropriately exists in the cathedral, if this is a backdoor introduction of lay residentiary canonries, it needs to be owned as such, and perhaps we should have a rather more detailed report on the subject, and perhaps we could actually have had a slightly deeper rationale on why we're taking away the six-year limit on the rest as well.
Thank you, sir.
Martin Kingston, Gloucester 314. I think it's important just to get a grip on what process is underway here, which is not at this stage to try and deal with the detail. And so the standing order reminder is important here. So, for example, should there be a requirement for both morning and evening worship? Well, you might like to write to the simplification group in whose work I confess a modest interest. Abolishing parishes. If we want to spend the next part of this quinquennium looking as though we're firmly obsessed with the way we do things, then suggest in rural England that you might abolish the parishes. And we can spend the next 3 years firmly obsessed with our own business rather than propagating the gospel. The idea of moving to a benefice-centred approach is perhaps rather like moving the piano foot by foot by foot to discover at the end of the process that, wow, the piano has moved and we thought it didn't need to move at all. That's not to say that we're creeping towards abolishing parishes, but it is to say that this measure is designed in the way it's being put forward to enable change to be tested, if you like, allow people to get the flavour of how it could work in effective ministry of the gospel in a larger benefice. And that's what we need to focus on, not on promoting things that will make us look even more internally self-obsessed. Thank you.
Thank you. Don't see anybody standing. I therefore call on the Archdeacon to respond to the debate. She has up to 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. Again, I welcome your considered and thoughtful responses. I should say, in terms of morning and evening prayer, The parishioners of a parish are entitled to expect morning and evening prayer. You may feel that they wouldn't expect it, but they are entitled to it. I might personally feel that we might do well as a church to pray morning and evening in all of our churches, or as many of them as we can, but this isn't really a personal matter. If you are using some of the provisions under common worship, you may find that services of the word, family services and so on, do in fact fulfil the requirements of morning and evening prayer in any case. I thank Mr. French for those observations, but also for his comments about ministry, worship and governance under Canon B43. Ministry and worship, yes indeed. Governance, finance and so on, we must be careful. We cannot in our canons legislate for other churches and other denominations. So by all means do write in, but we do just need to be mindful of that ecumenical courtesy and sensitivity. Caroline Graham, and your point on gender-neutral language, yes, indeed. If we were inventing the Church of England from scratch, it might not look like this. And if we were writing our legislation from scratch, it might not look like this. So I think the answer is we do what we can, but it's not always possible to redraft everything. But please, again, write in. Paul Hutchinson's point about canons residentiary. I hope I have not misled Synod, but it is not my understanding that this measure or canon in any way intend to introduce lay canons residentiary, or to put it another way, to remove the requirement that canons residentiary are clerks in holy orders. Nevertheless, you are not the only person who has raised this point with me, and you may therefore wish to write in with the detail so that we know exactly which bit of drafting needs to be improved. And I thank you for that observation. I thank Mike Stalibras for his endorsement of the presentation of the before and after effects of legislative change, and again assure Synod that that will continue to be done as we go forward wherever is practical. And finally, Judith Segal and the question of larger parishes rather than multi-parish parish benefices. It is my understanding that if you can persuade the parishes and you can persuade your diocesan mission and pastoral committee to make a recommendation to the bishop, the way is open to do that. The ifs may be rather large, but I do think it can be done. And finally, Mr. Baldry on festival churches. The pertinence is not clear to me, but the speech was wonderful. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. I now put item 507 to the vote. Would those in favour please show? Thank you. Would those against please show? Thank you. That item is clearly carried. The draft amending canon is now automatically committed to revision committee. As it states in the agenda, any member who wishes to submit proposals for amendment should send them in writing to the clerk of the synod to reach her no later than Monday the 20th of March. Monday 20th of March for any writing to the clerk about proposed amendments. That completes this item of business. Thank you.